So, we are starting James. But as always, we're not going to start right in James. We're going to start in Genesis. One of the reasons we start in Genesis is because the Bible is God's story. Unfortunately, for some reason, we've come up with the idea that the Bible is a self-help book for us. It is not. And that makes a lot of difference how we read it. So we need to understand that it's God's story and not a self-help book. It's a revelation of who God is, what he's like, and how he expresses himself, how he functions. All of the language of Scripture is actually premised on that context, that this is a book about who God is, how he expresses himself. We'll not understand God's story, though, unless we understand his language. In other words, the way in which he expresses himself and defines life. So it's really important that we understand his language. So I'm going to share a little vignette, and I'm going to just share little pieces at a time, and we'll get to that. But one of the things I had to do for class, the January class, was I had to picture my birth, what I assumed it was like, and who was there of all the people that probably were maybe there or could have been there, the people that were intimate in my life at that time, and just picture that birth. And as you're picturing your mother in the hospital bed or wherever she might have been, with you as a baby, now picture yourself being passed around to all those people that were intimate in your life at the beginning. So that was an exercise that I had to do. So we'll get back to that. But I want you to just take a second and do the same thing. So you might want to close your eyes and think about your birth and think about who might have been there. Picture a room with all those people standing around there. And picture you as a baby being passed around to each of those. The last person I want you to see yourself being passed to is Jesus. Okay. So we'll get back to that piece. But I want to talk about language again. Because if we're looking at God's story and it's written in his language, we need to understand his language. Because language determines how we think about everything, how we frame everything. Language actually conveys meaning, but it conveys meaning according to a certain goal. And in biblical speech, we talk about a goal being a telos, an end goal. So telos actually means end, the finish, where you're going toward. So that's what language does. Language actually conveys meaning according to where it thinks life is going. It defines then the context of what we mean by life. So it determines how you see life. So if we were to think about the romantic languages, in fact, almost all of you wanted to learn a romantic language. It was interesting. So you know the romantic languages, right? Mm-hmm. Spanish, French, Portuguese, Italian. German is not a romantic language at all. Not even close. Romantic language, probably, my guess would be that the telos of a romantic language is that it sees life as a romance. Germanic languages, so German, English, no, those would be
Russian
might be, Swedish. Anything that sounds very stilted would be a Germanic language. Most likely, the Germanic languages see life as something as a practical endeavor. Okay, so when you think about that, think about Germans, think about the idea is everything is clicked in order. Arabic languages, and I'm guessing at this because I don't know enough Arabic, but Arabic languages probably is also order. So it's why we probably confuse it with a Germanic language. Mm. Think about where we get our numeral system. from the Arabic language. So you see that they actually have behind them is a telos of what they think life is like. But other than those languages, which we would call foreign languages, there are other kinds of languages. Karen mentioned that she would like to learn sign language, right? So there's that kind of a language. But there are languages that we also use and are fluent in that I would call, and I've never seen this anywhere, what people call it, but I would call it a contextual language. Contextual languages are languages that we're actually fluent in. And in the world, I think now, in our world here, I would name five. There's probably more. They probably all fit in, though, into these five. I would say there is a marketplace language. There is a battle language. And when I mean battle, I also mean games. So a game language, a battle language. There's religious language. There's political language. And there's scientific language. But there's also body language, right? And we talked a lot about body language in Ephesians.
Body language.
And body language is actually acquired before verbal language. But body language will use those contextual languages of market, battle, religion, politics, and science.
So by these, do you mean like, so markets, like the business world, like this kind of lingo that you use, like specific words, and like science would be like healthcare. Like, I would, is that what you mean?
Well, let me go on, and then we'll kind of see where you're going. Did anybody see the movie Arrival? Nobody. Oh, okay.
Arrival.
It's recent. Amy Adams. It's a really good movie. But it actually hones into this idea of language, the kind of languages and how determinant they are in how we see life. So if you want to see a good language, I'm trying to think if there's anything in there that anyone would, I think no. I think it's a great movie. But it gives you an idea of what this is, and I'll go into that. Because our brains, our minds as human beings are plastic, which means able to be manipulated and molded, we're adept at most of these languages. We're multilingual and can switch back and forth between the two, between one or two of them. All of these languages use the same words, but they mean something different because each of the language has a different telos, has a different idea of where they think life is going, what's most important about life. So we've got to be attentive. We've got to really attune ourselves to what context those languages are speaking, to where they actually think life is going. Now, we usually don't consciously think about this. But when we stop and think about this, we'll understand and realize that that's what's going on. If I were just to say the word C.
Which word?
C.
C?
C.
S-E-A-S-E.
Okay. So it could be. It could be. Yes, it could be many things, right? But it's the same sounds, right? So it could be, I see something. It could be, there's a C outside in my backyard. It could be the letter C, or it could be, somebody heard it, Spanish, right? So depending on how I use it, it's going to tell you something, right? So that isn't enough. The words aren't enough, right? What else do you need to know what I'm saying? I need to frame it. I need context, right? And what kind of context do I need to give you in order for you to understand what I'm saying?
A sentence.
Okay, but what if all I say is, see?
Surrounding environment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so how are you going to know if I say, what if Yolanda says to you, see? What are you going to say?
See what?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, so now you might have two different conflicts, because most of us who know Yolanda would probably say, she probably wants you to look at her dessert and say, see how it tastes, right? But if you don't know Yolanda, you might look at her and say, is she trying to speak Spanish to me? So context is going to really help, not just the sentences, but what you actually see, right? What is enfleshed? What's going on around you? If I say, see, and I go like this, you might look outdoors. Mm-hmm. And if you actually are over there and you look that way and you can see into my neighbor's yard, you're going to see a sea of water out there. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on you paying attention, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You've got to pay attention, which is why people hate when you're talking with someone and they're looking around, right? Mm-hmm. They're not paying attention. And it gets even more frustrating if you're talking to someone, they're looking around, and you say, you haven't heard a word I said, right? And then they say, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you said, and they parrot it back. But what's the problem? They've missed the context. Mm-hmm. They have no idea. They know the words you've said, but because they don't know the context, we know they're not paying attention, and therefore, they're not bringing it into themselves.
That's why emails are bad.
Yeah, and it is exactly why that type of conversation is very difficult, mm-hmm. and why it doesn't help us to integrate with one another. Sure. So the languages we use are really important, and it's really important for us to be attentive to the languages that we're using. We speak a lot of languages. We use a lot of languages. So in the contextual languages that I talked about, I could use the same word, run, but I can use it in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. So in the marketplace, I might say, there's a run on milk today. Mm-hmm. What do I mean when I'm using it that way? I mean, I framed it, it's in the marketplace. So what do I mean by that? Like, what do I want you to do? Right, because marketplace says you better go get it now if you want to have that good transaction, right? Mm-hmm. If in battle I say, or games, run the race, what do I want you to do running the race?
Stay in it.
Yeah. Even more so. What's the tell-off? Win it, right? If religious talk, if I say, we will run this order by Benedictine rules. Why do I want to do that? Why do I want to run?
Organize.
Order.
Or for what purpose?
Mm-hmm. Order.
Order
focus.
For
a specific order. Focus our minds on
whatever
Benedict.
Yeah. Sorry. So in religious talk, it's always to do what's right, live what's right, right? And when I say religious, I don't mean what the Bible's teaching us. I just mean religion, mm-hmm. okay? Big religion. Political, I'm going to run for president. Mm-hmm. What's my goal, really, in running for president?
Be elected.
For what purpose?
To rule,
right? To have power over, right? And science, a run of experiments was conducted. For what purpose? Yeah, to get an answer. So to prove what's true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you see, so now, Lisa, does that make sense?
Yep.
One time. Okay. So those type of languages, and we don't delineate often that there are different languages here. But the problem is we actually do use all of those languages. And most of the times we know what's going on. Problem is if we're not attentive to that, we will begin to misinterpret lots of things. We will, if we have one particular language, and all of us do, if we have one particular language that we gravitate toward, that we use more often, we will use that for everything, and it will determine how we see life. So it's really important that we pay attention to that, particularly because under duress, no matter how many of the languages we're fluent in, under duress, there are going to be one of two things that might happen. What with our language. Because we have a dominant language, whether you know it or not, you have a dominant contextual language. But if I'm under duress, whether I'm taken by surprise, or I'm tired, or I'm hungry, or I'm hurt, or I'm scared, or I'm mad, we will do one of two things. First thing is we will either respond with our default language, our dominant language. That which is really a part of us, that which by how we see life. So someone who's angry suddenly begins to shout and curse in his native tongue, right? You've seen that, right? You've also seen And because my in-laws were German and they spoke German, when they got nervous or confused, they would revert to German. Even though they were adamant about everybody speaking English, it would still revert. It would naturally happen. So emotion is going to cause us to either go back, revert to our dominant language, one of our dominant contextual languages, or we'll actually lose our language altogether. We'll lose language. We'll lose our framing of what I believe life is like. And we'll let the other person who's conversing with us, that how they have framed life, their dominant language, we'll let that take over. And the best example here is, and I'm sure that every one of you has had this opportunity to have this happen, is when things get either complicated or controversial. So how many of you had discussions or entered into conversation in this last year about politics? Tough times, right? And sometimes what will happen is it will get emotional. And you may start using your dominant language. And this happens all the time. This happens especially in controversial issues, right? Sometimes you may use your dominant language. And you might be using two different languages. All the words are the same. But you might be using two different languages, right? I'm talking marketplace language, and they're talking power, political language. But you also might lose your language, and you just, like, bow out, like you just let them. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon, you're talking with their language. You're talking all marketplace language. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. This happens to us all the time, and we don't recognize it because we're not paying attention to the fact that underlying all the words we're using, we're actually using a contextual language as well. So, back to the exercise I had you do, the exercise I had to do. And by the way, I did this exercise as I was sitting in the corner over there. The Christmas tree was there, and I'm kind of back there. While my whole family, Bill, Christian, Lissa, Ben, and Andrea, were all off of work. And I'm doing schoolwork. Oh, and it's Christmas. And they were here for a week, all of them.
Oh, wow.
So I'm doing this. So I'm having to do this picture of myself as a baby being handed around to all the people that I knew were in my life at that time with Jesus in there. So I had to do that. So I did that. And literally, this isn't anything I know, but as I pictured it, no one wanted to hold me, including Jesus. And I'm sitting there, and everybody else is around, and I'm just like, oh, where did that come from? Well, it came from a context, right? There was a context, even though unaware, I don't really know what happened. There is no one alive that would have been anywhere around that I could even ask. But I know the context, and I know the sense of the context I had all growing up. Wow. And that is that my mother ran away and married at 15. She was just into her 16th year when she had me. Wow. Mm-hmm. So things were obviously scandalous, right? She was young. She had me. The other context I know is I know at some point in my young life, so I had a large family, had lots of aunts, and I'm not sure how this happened, but somewhere in the family, they decided that it would be best for one of the aunts to adopt me and my sister. Mm-hmm. And so we used to spend weekends. I never knew this, but I sensed it. We spent weekends at, she happened to be a wealthy woman, and we spent weekends at her home all the time. I think it was preparing everybody mm-hmm. for that. So that's another piece of the context, right? Mm-hmm. But here's what that did for me. That context helped me form that picture. And what it has said to me my entire life is, the context is, I'm not right. It's not right for this young woman to have this kid. Mm-hmm. 15 years old, she gets married, gets pregnant, and has a baby. Within a year, we moved back into my grandmother's house, and she was divorced. So my picture was always, that wasn't right, that wasn't good. What language do you think I learned? What was my dominant language that I began to learn? Which language is good, bad, right, wrong? Religion. So no surprise that I gravitated toward religion very young in life. Because that was the language I was learning, sensing. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
So what I do with that, what I've done with that is, it said to me, I'm not lovable, but I could be right. Right? Therefore, no surprise that I always struggle with, I've got to do my very best, right? I've got to be straight A's, right? So, and you know that today, that's still there, right? That's still a piece of me. And there's still this piece of, I'm not lovable. So that will never happen. Therefore, the language that I've learned is what I will see life as. Does that make sense? Do you see how important language is?
Is it something that you think that can change?
Yeah. So that's kind of where we're going to get into. Is yes, of course that can change. But I think we need to understand that every one of us carries a dominant language. And it comes from what you've grown up with. It actually comes from, so a lot of this is neurological science. And they actually have done lots and lots of study on the brain and what happens to infants and what they're assessing. They actually can begin to sense the dominant language in utero. So they begin to sense languages in utero. Once the verbal language comes, it just reinforces the sensations that they have taken in. So languages really are important because now they will curve you towards a certain telos. So for my entire life, has this been obvious to me? In some ways, yes. But in other ways, no. That picture that I had of me being passed around and no one wanting me, including Jesus, freaked me out. And of course, you know, I'm sitting there in tears, like coming down. I can't believe that this is what is true. But then it began to make sense, right? All of the things that I've strived for have never been to be lovable. In fact, I'd go back to, remember several times I asked the question, would you rather be popular or smart? Mm-hmm. What did I always answer?
Smart.
Why didn't I answer popular?
She didn't feel like you'd ever be popular.
Right. Yeah. Wasn't possible for me, right? So, did you see that?
Yeah.
So when you understand that everyone is working under a language, a contextual language, now you begin to understand why people are the way they are, which is going to help you, right? But it doesn't mean, like Karen says, it doesn't mean that it has to be static. But because we don't talk about this, because we don't even explore it in our own lives, it usually stays static. Words can't change it. But words can help. So, what in the world does this have to do with reading James? We have to be aware of reading James from our own contextual languages, from our own dominant languages that we default to. James is God's story, and it is written in God's language. So we've got to read it in that definitive language. If we're going to understand our own stories, they've got to be put in the right context. And the context is God's story. We are in God's story. We've got to be able to read not only God's story in the right context, but our story in the right context. Was my context, what I just told you, the context of religion, good or bad? By the way, nobody in my family went to church, so it didn't come from that. It's just a contextual language. Was my context correct?
No,
it wasn't. It was not correct. Interesting enough, and I didn't do this because I wanted someone to change my context. It didn't even occur to me that I could change my context. But I shared it with both of my kids and with Bill at separate times. So I shared it with the kids, and they were very empathetic. I shared with Bill. It was really interesting. His immediate response was, "That's not true." Mm-hmm. What that did for me is it mm-hmm. cut that off. Mm-hmm. It interrupted it and it said, "There might be another language to be able to assess that again with." Mm-hmm. So that ability to say that's not true. Now, did Bill know?
No.
He knows all of that stuff that went on. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know who was there. He has no idea what happened. But he was adamant that's not true. Mm-hmm. So that interruption actually pulled me back. It didn't change it, but it pulled me back. So that was kind of the beginning of maybe changing gears. But it's why we actually study God's word. We want to understand God's life because he's the one who defines life. We're in his story. And if we read his biography in any other language but the original, in other words, not Greek or Hebrew, but what he says is life, we will define life in one of those contextual ways. Mm-hmm. It won't be in God's contextual language. It will be in another contextual language. All of us have done this already. It's not like you can already, you know, make one up. We've already done it. But there's a language that can replace that because that's the true language of where we actually fit into the story. We're more practiced in the contextual languages that I listed than we are in God's language. Completely practiced. And we're so practiced in those languages that we've brought them into the church, right? And we've begun to talk about God's story in those languages. And therefore, it's not very inviting to us or anyone else. But sometimes, particularly when you grew up with the religious language, I can fit myself into a religion really easily. Oh, right and wrong. That's the only way. That's what life is all about, right and wrong. And I am going to try my hardest to be right. So religion fit me easily. I can see why it was at 10 years old, why I'm the one going to church out of my family. I'm the one dragging my three sisters. I'm the one, and I laugh at this now, and this is the stories my sisters tell. Yeah, you not only would you make us go to church with you, on the way home, by the time you were a teenager and you were driving, on the way home, you would make us sing, "Onward Christian Soldier." And, I mean, they made fun of me. But that's what I was determined that that's what would happen. So I fit well into those languages. I understood that language because that's the language that was really spoken in my growing up years. But all of those languages are dualistic languages. In other words, they're either or languages. Mm-hmm. So marketplace language sees everything as a transaction. It's either, and the premise of a transaction is that it's fair exchange. But the truth of it is, when you do a transaction, do you really want fair exchange?
No, you want better.
You want better, right? You want a deal. It's always, I want to get more than I give. So a transaction is always that way. Transaction is, I get for what I give, but I get more than what I give. Battle language, games, races, is competitive, and it sees everything in terms of winners and losers. So what happens is we get caught up in one of these languages, and we see life as that. It's what life is all about, winning or losing. And I'm sure we all know someone or ourselves who thinks life is always about winning or losing, right? Religious language is about appeasing, and it sees everything in terms of right or wrong. Good or bad. Political language is hierarchical, and it sees everything as power over, submission under, or success and failure. So this is where business and career would fit in. We're always taught, right, are you successful? Or are you a failure? There's no in between, right? So all of these languages are dualistic. It's either this or it's that. And it's pretty much, it's either this, which is good, and that, which is bad. Scientific language is provable, and it sees everything as either reasonable or unreasonable, true or false. Did somebody have a question?
Yes.
No. Karen was saying, we're scientific. So once we get into James, what we're going to notice is that it's replete with that fundamental idea of the what underlies language. James will say, so you think your language says life is this way, but God's language says life is this way. So you're going to see this all over James. This versus this. This versus this. You think that's the way to get life. It's not, because God's language says it's this. Which makes a huge difference. I find it fascinating that James is interesting. It's been one of the most controversial New Testament books. But it's also the most beloved book by just the regular people and the most memorized, which I think is really interesting, because I will bet you that you've read James from a contextual language. I will bet you that. And if so, it makes me wonder what we're memorizing. What are we taking in? What kind of a language are we taking it in with?
God's way versus my way kind of sounds like back in the garden.
Yeah. Wow. We'll definitely get to there. But you're going to see how that happens. And I'm going to bring in some neurology about that. So that we understand what's happening in the brain as well. So that we begin to see it a little differently. But why is there a difference between what God says and all of those other contextual languages? Because every contextual language has a telos to it. Every language you use, your body language incorporated into any of those contextual languages, has a telos. And the telos... Yeah.
The word telos?
Yeah.
Define it.
Somebody define it for me. End goal. Right.
End goal.
End goal.
Would you say God's telos is like connection? Like all these are like win or lose or win or true or false. And God's is like connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, what, of course, we'll go to Genesis and look at. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. So telos is end goal. Interesting enough, telos is actually used a lot of the times, but when we don't know a word, we kind of skip over it. But I noticed this last semester, somebody came to me and said, oh my gosh, I've heard this word now 3 or 4 times in different contexts. Mm-hmm. So it's a word that's out there. We use it. It is Greek for end goal.
Is that T-E-L-O-S
is telos. It's actually, you know it by tetelestai. Maybe you've heard tetelestai. Have you heard that? It's what Jesus says on the cross. It is finished. Tetelestai. Yeah. Reach the end goal. So if we're going to read James in God's language, we're going to need to be familiar with his language then, right? You all said you had this wish to learn a different language. Well, God has given us that ability to learn his language. He's shown us what his language is. That's why we begin with Genesis, because Genesis is the foundational revelation of his language, how he expresses himself and how he defines life. That's why we always go back to Genesis, because when we don't go back to Genesis, even no matter how much you've studied, you still have that dominant language that you tend to use. And you will begin to read each of God's parts of God's story from your dominant language. And then you'll come away with it, particularly something like James, which is it has the most commands of it in any New Testament. I think there's 56 commands, something like that. So you're going to come to 56 commands and you're going to put it in one of those contexts. It's either I've got to do this or else. It's going to be an if-then, right? It's going to be some kind of a transaction or approving what's true or right, what's good or bad. You're going to read it from one of those unless you've learned God's language and you frame it with that foundation. So that's why we go to Genesis.
Can I ask you, are you placing then the language of like psychology and science then?
Yes.
So
psychology actually goes over a couple, and that's why. So, like the arts go over a couple of them. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to give us a handy,
simple
one. But yes, psychology actually uses some science, but they also use some of the others as well. So I think what I'd like us to do before we begin in Genesis 1 is to just together read James, our memory verse. So open up your brochure or your Bible. You're going to be opening up your Bible, so that'd be fine. But I'd like to all say it from NAS, so maybe the brochure would be best. So James 1, 18 through 22. Ready? In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. This you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Therefore, putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness, in humility, receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. But prove yourselves doers of the word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. Okay. It'd be interesting to know what kind of contextual language you think you're reading it from, because it for sure make a difference. So, Genesis 1, open up. So, we have 45 minutes. I'm trying to think, how do I get through Genesis 1 and 2? I'm going to go through most of this pretty fast, mainly because, for the majority of you, this is review. You've heard this already. You've heard the language that I'm going to use already. You understand. I mean, Laura Jean has already said, well, I know what language God uses. We should. But we're going to get even a little deeper involved. So I'm going to go as quickly as I can. For those of you who are new, we're going to talk about things maybe you haven't heard before. Certainly some words you haven't heard before. You can ask me about it. Here would be my suggestion. Maybe listen to Sabbath 1 and 2. Would you say that would be a good place? Yeah. So if you have time, the Sabbath lessons 1 and 2, really talk about Genesis 1 and 2 and really what's going on there. So today I'm not going to talk about ontology, but I think it's important. And it will perhaps answer some questions for you. So God's expressed identity, which means his language, right? His identity expressed to us is his language. So it's threefold. First of all, it's functionally creative. What do I mean by that? So we always call God, first of all, creator, right? That's what we always go to Genesis 1 for, as creator. His creative abilities is his function. It's how he functions. It's how he works. And he does so by two ways. First of all, by establishing order. Remember, we've talked about this. It's not so much, this is part of it, but Genesis 1 doesn't talk about creating material pieces. It actually talks about creating order, function. So his creativity, how he works, is that he's always establishing order. And he does this in Genesis 1 for the benefit of humanity. So when you talk about who God is and how he functions, we know that he is a God who actually is paying attention to the needs of others. So when we look at Genesis 1, 1 and 2, I mean, most of us could probably quote this, right? God said, let there be light, and there was light, right? So we know he establishes order. And remember, see, I don't want to get into the ontology here, but he's establishing, do you remember what he's establishing? Like what order?
Time. And then the water.
Weather, weather. Right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, weather.
Weather, water cycle. And food light. Production, right? Growth, food production. So he's establishing those, and that's part of who he is, that he establishes order for the benefit of others. And he does that by actually bringing his word into being. So this is important as we understand James. His words are not merely information. We tend in the West to think about words as information, right? I'm giving you lots of words as information. But what God does with his words is he brings his words into being. He actually enfleshes them in some way. That's kind of a hard word to use, but I think it'll help us understand that his word actually gets enfleshed. Doesn't always have to be in a physical like this or this, but in Genesis 1, a lot of times it's he enfleshes, he brings his word to a function, to an order, to a system. It's like when I'm creating a business, right? Is there something physical about that business? No, when I say I create a business or a committee, when I say I create a committee, there are people that are involved in that committee, but creating a committee, you can't really hold on to a committee, right? Mm-hmm. But it's something that is more than an idea, right? I've actually made it happen. So he brings his word into being. So he incarnates, he gives it flesh, he gives it expression. And that expression is of his being, right? It's from within him. He brought out something from within him and made it into being, made it exist. And remember, we talked about the definition of existence for ancient would be that it has a function, right? Nothing exists without a function. So function comes first. How does he do that? How does he bring things into being? How does he bring his word into being? This one you guys know. Three ways. How way? Names, tends, and make space. Okay? So he names things. He actually gives them a name, a specific name. He calls it good, right? So in Genesis 1, we have in verse 8, verse 10, and verse 12, and we keep going there, we have him, he called the light, light, and he saw that it was good. Notice also, and we talked about this last semester, that in the naming, he always separates so that he makes distinctions between things. The bigger light for the governing of the day and the lesser lights for the governing of the night, right? So he separates. He always distinguishes one between the other. So that's all in naming. It's how he brings his word into being. He calls it good, and he separates. He distinguishes. In other words, he gives it worth, right? That's what we mean by naming. When I name you, I give it worth. When I say to Karen, Karen, I like the color of your hair this time. So what I've done is I've named her and given her worth, but in naming her Karen, I'm not talking about any one of you. I'm talking about Karen, right? I've separated her from everyone else, not to make her superior, but to say, Karen, you're valuable. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So the separating, the distinguishing between Karen and Linda is important because it gives you worth. It's nice for if I said, oh, I like the color of all your hairs today. Kind of loses it, doesn't it? And interesting.
So yours is really cute, and it's actually similar to Karen's.
It's interesting, Lord Jean, that you kind of said, "Yeah, thanks." Sometimes people will be bold enough, extroverted enough, to be able to say, "I want to be singled out too." So thank you. You know, right? So it's bringing that we all want to be singled out as being seen, as being known. That's what God does in creating. So that's part of creating, right?
The need.
Yep. Tending. He tends by giving something purpose, giving it place and purpose. So he tends to the functions and functionaries, the time, the weather, etc., but then to the beasts and the humans, he assigns them purpose, right? And purpose always means there's a connection with life in some way. So purpose is always a part of connection. You don't have purpose outside of yourself. I mean, within yourself. You have purpose only in connection with others. So that's part of creating. So when I create let's say I do it the very physical. Let's say I create a painting and I don't let anyone see it. It's not really the definition of creating because there's no purpose for it. If the purpose is only for me, it's not really considered existing in metaphysics. Does that make sense? I don't want to go that direction, but
yeah, but that's a fulfilling from within. You're creating this,
but you don't want to share it. So that's
maybe
it.
Not
right. So that, but that is the process of what God says his life is, that it actually gets expressed and it gets connected. So remember, we're talking, what's God language? What does God say life is? Life is actually connecting things with purpose, right? Giving
for the
purpose.
Benefit of others.
For the benefit of others. Always for the benefit of others. And then by giving space to grow. So that actually means giving it the ability to participate in connection. So even the sun and the moon have the ability to participate in connection with all of creation. And Karen, it's interesting that you would bring that up, because like there's sometimes we want to express ourselves, but we don't want to show it.
Right.
What God's language says is that's not creation. You're not reflecting me in that, because life actually means connection. Does that make sense?
I think the majority of the time, most of us think life means what brings me temporary happiness.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. So do you see all of a sudden this subtle switch?
And then we even say, well, doesn't God?
Yep. And what does he really want? He wants this
connection.
And we see this is why Genesis 1 and 2 is so important. We understand that when he creates, he names, he gives you value. He says you care and are important, but he also gives you purpose, which means he connects you. He gives you space to participate in life.
But I share it with you and you know, in your
okay.
mind, or you wouldn't.
So, isn't that interesting? What you just did is started to reveal to me what language you operate under.
Next.
No, Karen, that's good, because all of us do that, right? The reason we do, and once I get into Genesis 3, you're going to understand what is happening to you, what your dominant language is doing to your brain to be able to make you do that and actually pull away from connection. You see why Genesis 1? I mean, there's so much there. We could spend all of our Bible study time in Genesis 1 and begin to see how God has developed us. And he keeps saying, no, no, this is the language of life. This is what's true. This is the language you need to begin to adapt. And I'll show you the ways that I can help you adapt it. So that's how God is functionally creative. So that's what it means to be functionally creative. It's not just, our words, our language, our way of expressing ourselves is not creative unless it's actually connected. Secondly, he is relationally cohortative. Okay, so now all the new people, they're like, what have I gotten into? So, somebody read for me verse 126.
And God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.
Okay. So far, up to this point, there's been a pattern, right? One of the things we do is study it literarily, and there's been a pattern in the Hebrew that's written here, and it's, God said, let there be light, and there was light, and it was good, and it was the first day. God said, let there be, and it will be. All of a sudden, the pattern is interrupted. All of a sudden, it's not third-person narrator saying, God said, and it was. All of a sudden, we actually have God's language, right? He actually speaks. And what does he say? Let us make man in our image. If you were reading in Hebrew, you would notice that not just has the pattern changed, but actually the tense and the voice has changed. So we don't have voice in English, but if you were studying any other language, you would know that there's a voice part of language. In here, the voice changes to what is called cohortative. And that's how we actually know that this, that we can put us in here, how they can translate this us. Because the voice changes, and the voice of cohortative actually means that what is speaking now is actually in a cohort. So that word you know, right? Cohort. The funny thing is, in the English language, cohort is kind of a negative, right? When I would say, when I was first teaching about cohort, and I would say to Bill, I'm going to teach on cohorts today, and he said, cohort, that's not a good thing. Like, so all he knew was a negative connotation of it.
Why is it a negative?
Because usually cohorts are somebody who's, are like, right,
closed,
and kind of, and it's also a very military term. But that is English language. Hebrew language? No. The language, the cohort language actually talks about the fact that the being that's talking in the cohortative voice is there is more than two. Okay, so that there is actually a cohort. There is a being that has more than two in here. But there's diversity. So you know that I'm in school and I'm in a cohort. So if you are in the college scene now, cohorts are very popular. It's one way of educating. And cohorts mean that you go throughout all your years of education with the same people so that you begin to make connections with one another, right? You all of a sudden begin to be an entity as one. So we have 10 people in our cohort, and the new professor walked in and he said, now I know you guys know each other really well, and you've become like this unit. I'm a visitor into your cohort, and I'm hoping you'll allow me into your cohort. Mm-hmm. Interesting, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what happens with a cohort, that professors actually come in and realize, they haven't come into a class and said, this is my class. They've come into a cohort that says, oh, there's a cohort. Can I be invited into that? So a cohort then, in the educational sense, in any other true sense, is a organization of people that are actually there for one another. So they're actually there to support the other. A couple examples.
It's kind of like when a newbie comes into this group.
Yep, so you have to kind of come in. And what hopefully you see when you come into the group is that these people are for the other. Like, we belong together, and we're going to help one another. Last night, there was a young man who was in our cohort who was not able to be there for our first class. And he came in, and the professor is lecturing, and I can hear him say to the person next to me, what does he mean by that? Because he missed. And so as a cohort member, I mean, I'm on my computer, he's on his computer, I just immediately sent him my notes from last time. That's cohort, right? Mm-hmm. I want him to be able
to understand.
It's not like, oh, I took these good notes. And no, you weren't here, right? Which is actually what happens most of the time in classrooms. Mm-hmm. Until you're in a cohort. And in a cohort, all of a sudden, you're together. So before this class started, this is a new professor, kind of new out of his PhD. We've already had experience with one like this. And we looked at his syllabus as we're in our last intensive class, and the syllabus was like crazy. We're still doing our work from last class. So we were all talking about it. Since we're a cohort, we're all like, what are we going to do about this? Yeah. Well, let's together go and talk to the head of the department and see if there can be some kind of change. So the only time the head was there was after, we were in class 8 hours, and it's 6 o'clock, and he couldn't meet for another half hour, so we have to wait around. Well, there was lots of people who couldn't do that, but we're a cohort, right? So the ones who could go, we all go together and talk with the head of the department. Mm. There's one girl in there who, you know, is just a dear, but she would never, ever question authority. So even though she might have been able to go, one of us said, you know, she's not going to be comfortable in this. Mm-hmm. let's be her representative as well, right? She would never ask a teacher that. But as a cohort, we went together. So four of us went and talked with the head of the department on behalf of everyone, right? So in other words, I didn't look at that syllabus and go, that is ridiculous. I'm going to go talk to someone. I'm not going to do that work. We all go, right? We're all supporting the other. We all want everyone to succeed in here. That's what a cohort does, right? It is diverse. There's very diverse in the class in some respects, very diverse. I mean, we have a lawyer, we have an accountant, we have a pastor. You know, we have lots of different others. So it's diverse, but together we're unified, right? There's a unity.
And the end result?
Oh, we got changed.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. I mean, it was a great thing to be able to do that.
But what if one person didn't agree with the rest of you?
Yeah. Well, and that might have happened our first year.
Okay, we're all on the same page.
We're all on the same page. We are able to talk it out. What do you feel about this? What do you feel about this? And every time we ask a question, so the young man who wasn't there last week emailed us this week. What homework do we have for this next week coming up? It's always reply all. Everybody gets to see the questions and answers and everything. Now, did that happen in the beginning? Nope. It had to grow that way. But we all benefit from all of that, right? Which is why I say, if you have questions, say them, because somebody else is going to benefit from that. And if there was somebody who didn't disagree, somebody who didn't agree, then we would have to figure that one out too, right? But basically a cohort then always looks out for the other, because we see each other as different, but as one.
Well, isn't that what Christianity is
then? Hopefully.
It's supposed to be.
I think sometimes we mix so much of our contextual language in that we do a lot of us and them, right? Mm-hmm. So a cohort is diverse. It's other. It's made up of others, but it's also unity. It's us, right? Which is what the term here that God uses is, let us, and he's saying, this is who I am. This is what life is. When God defines himself, he's defining what life is. So it's always us. You don't ever see him saying, well, them. And you'll see at the end of Genesis 3, actually, what happens when somebody tries to be not us.
And I thought, just to clarify, too, like, I thought it was for me to understand that he's talking, this is his voice, because he's a Trinitarian God.
Right.
He's an us, and we are made in his image. Therefore, I'm not just Laura Jean.
Yep.
I'm us. I'm
the
body.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So in that diversity and unity, there is this vulnerability as well in a cohort. So there's this vulnerability of, I'm going to give all myself to you gladly, and you're going to give all of yourself to me gladly. We're going to have this vulnerability of giving ourselves all, so that when Dan asks for notes, so it used to be Dan would ask for notes, and I would give them freely. Now, I don't even wait for him to ask, right? I just give them. I just send them over to him right away. So giving fully and receiving fully then from somebody else. Like, this is great. This is part of what cohort is, and I'll gladly receive fully. But there's another part that we haven't talked about much, which really James talks about, and that is the integration of that then. So when I receive from you fully, so Karen, you give me something of yourself, and I'm going to give it out as well. I'm going to give myself out as well. When I give myself out, I'm not just giving myself out. I'm giving what I've taken of you that's integrated and then give out, right? Mm-hmm. So that looks like something like this. So what I give out is going to be, well, I'm going to wait a second on that. What I give out is going to be colored by what I've taken in. Mm-hmm. In other words, and this is a problem we have. Sometimes we think about the fact of giving, taking in and giving out. We think of ourselves as a tube. right? Is that we're just a funnel that God puts in. That's a bad picture. Because in that picture, it's just God pouring into us and us pouring out God. That's not how it happens. We're much more like a tree. In that, we take in the soil and the nutrients and everything. Does a tree spew out soil and nutrients?
No.
Sun, weather. What does it spew out?
Fruit.
Leaves. Shade. What has happened from here, from the soil and the nutrients and the sun, to here and the fruit? What's happened in between?
Transformation.
Yeah. It has formed. All the soil and nutrients have gone into the tree, and it actually integrated with the tree. So that who the tree is and who the soil and nutrients are have woven themselves together so that now they produce something new, different, right? So what the tree gives out looks like a combination, right, of those two.
The good and the bad, too. What you absorb, good and
bad. Yep. So we have this integration that happens in the midst of that. And that's important for us to know, especially as we go through James, that that's part of who God is. So remember, how do we symbolize the cohort, the cohortive nature of God?
The
perichoretic Mobius. So this is how it looks. We've used this a million times. I have tried forever and ever to find something that actually is the symbol in the thing.
Pass
that.
What?
Infinity
scarves, are those not twisted?
A what?
Infinity
scarf? Oh,
yeah,
but you can't.
You could, yeah. You can, but I wanted something, like in my head, I wanted metal, yeah. I actually tried to get someone to make it for me. They said it would be too expensive. There is jewelry. Lynn has actually given me a ring that's there's a necklace that's like that. But, well, I actually asked, would it be tough? Anyway, that's the picture, the symbol we use for the cohortative, or what we call it is perichoretic nature of God. Perichoretic means a circle that continues, right? But a circle that continues in on itself. Perichoretic, perichoretic. What that does is the Father gives himself totally to the Son. And the Son takes in totally of the Father, incorporates the Father with who he is, and then gives out to the Spirit, right? And the Spirit does the same thing. So that when Jesus comes to earth, it's why he can say, when you see me, you see the Father, right? Keep on. So that what you see coming out of the perichoretic nature is this this joyful taking in of the other. Like, I'm opening up to totally take you in. I'm not there as a static tube. I'm not there as a vessel. Sometimes we use that, and I think that's a bad metaphor. I think I'm there as a tree. God is there as a tree, and he's taking in everything to express then what God is like in my own way, right? What God is like coming through me, which is why each of us are able to express God in a different way. But we still are expressing God, right? We're still reflecting who he is. So that's what it means to be relationally cohortative. I'm sorry to use those big words, but I want you to get used to using that idea. And I think different words helps us stay out of our contextual languages. Thirdly, he is energetically fruitful. So in this perichoresis that he's dancing, that he's in, giving in, and taking, receiving and giving out. It's dynamic. It moves. There's actually a flow, which is why you'll see all those swirly lines in there. And the flow actually comes from the Father paying attention to the Son. The Son paying attention to the Father, and then paying attention to the Holy Spirit. the Holy Spirit paying attention to the Son and to the Father. So there's attention here. And that's important for us to understand that this attuning to. So when I want to, when you want to give of yourself to me, and I'm paying attention to that, I'll take in more, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you want to tell me some words, mm-hmm. and if I just say, Cindy, would you go do my garden? Mm-hmm. If you're paying attention to me, you're looking at my whole language, right? What I really want you to do. And you're taking that in attentively and saying, oh, that's what she wants. I'm paying attention to her. If I'm not, and this is what happens in our brain, right? Somebody's talking. What are we doing in our brain most of the time?
Think
about what you want to say next, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are you not doing?
Listen,
you're not attentive. You're not attuned to what they really want or need. So that when you now take your turn in the conversation and speak, what are you giving out? Just yourself. There's no connection. You've disconnected, right? In the perichoresis of God, or in this cohortive form, I'm taking in, and I'm so attentive. God is so attentive to the other in the Trinity that when he takes in, he gives out fully of himself and the other. So attention has a lot to do with it, and that attention actually makes it move. It actually gives life. But in that attention, as he's giving attention, that starts the movement, but what keeps the movement is that each other so enjoys taking in. Like, I get to take in all of her, and I get to filter it through me and give it out. There is created an emotion with that. Literally, there is created an emotion with taking in and giving out of me and that together. And why is that? Because that's who God is, that God has made us to be that way. And the emotion that comes from that is joy. Literally in the brain, joy actually happens, and joy actually energizes then the movement so that it keeps going. I've been reading fascinating things about the brain and joy and the ability of connection to bring joy and then joy to energize that circle that it keeps on going. When that happens, from integration, from being attentive and then integrating the other into myself and giving out, and that joy happens, what happens with the joy is that fruit is produced. Something else is produced that isn't either this one or that one, but it's both, right? So what the Holy Spirit gives out from bringing in the Son, who brought in the Father, is this fruit that looks like the Father and the Son, right? So, and you'll see this. Oh, so this is a picture of two little girls, right? Other, right? Two different girls, right? They look alike. They both look externally alike because they have pretty much the same outfits on, right? But you'll have to look at their faces. Do they look alike? I'll pass it around. They do look alike.
Are they twins?
No, they're not twins. They're mother and daughter.
Okay.
So as you look at them, you'll see that the mother gave out something that looked a lot like her, but not exactly like her, right? It gave out something that looked like the mother and the father. So the father and the son. Right? They look alike externally because they're wearing the same clothing, but they actually look like within they look themselves. So there's this diversity, but unity, right? And so mother and father produce fruit that looks like a combination, right? Because they've actually literally, physically integrated both persons, right? We know that, right? Most of the time that you have children, there you can see some resemblance of both in them. The initial attention paid to the other is what brings the connection, and the giving of one to the other fully brings joy that energizes and makes life, right? So that is, when you think about the language of God, that's the language of God. So Laura Jean says, the language of God is connection. Yes, but it's a certain kind of connection, right? It's a connection of fully giving to the other and an integration of the two, and then a giving out, right? So a lot of times we talk about connection as pretty superficial. Like the connection between the kids could just be that the two girls are dressed in sailor suits and the two boys are dressed in lederhosen. But there's more than that, right? Because there's been an integration. So I could have gotten any two boys to dress in lederhosen. But there's not the only connection is surface. But the connection of those two is that there was actually an integration. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about connection, when you talk about God's language being connective, it's an integrative connection. And that's really important because all of our contextual languages don't integrate. Remember, they're dualistic, right? It's either this or this. It's not this.
Bill and Christian?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You and Melissa?
Mm-hmm.
What a great idea.
I actually have one of me and my mom. That and most of these, I mean, we didn't know, like, I didn't pose Christian like that because of that picture. I didn't know about that picture.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. And the picture of my mom and me is about at the same age. I was a senior in high school, and I think her picture is a sophomore in high school. And we have almost the same outfit on. But that happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're integrated,
mm-hmm.
That happens. So functionally creative, relationally cohortative, energetically fruitful. I know that's a handful. Just remember that God's language is creation, always for the benefit of others, right? Naming, tending, and giving space for the benefit of others. Cohortative, perichoretic, that it gives in and gives out and integrates. And fruitful, that integration always produces joy and fruit. The joy is what keeps it going so that it's not stagnant and doesn't die. And the fruit comes out of that incorporation and joy. That's what God is like. That's what he says life is like. What's the telos of God? What is his desired goal for himself and others? How does he express that desire or his telos? And that is Sabbath, which is, you know, all of last semester. Sabbath is his goal for all of life. Sabbath, remember, is anybody, can anybody give me a good definition of Sabbath?
Place where we allow, or his order reigns.
Excellent. So Sabbath is the place where God can rest. And what we mean by rest is to rule and to relate, right? Twofold, is to rule and to relate without obstacle. And remember, if God's ruling is always creative, it's always for the benefit of others. Because when we think rule, when we think that word, we think rule so I get power, right? God's rule is always creative, so it's always for the benefit of others. And Sabbath, the telos of where God says life is going, where life should end up, is always Sabbath, the place where God can rule for the benefit of others, where he can order. Like, it gives him great delight to order for you. He's thrilled at it. And where he can relate with you without obstacle. That's the telos of God, that we can dwell in, that he can dwell in Sabbath space, that he can dwell there, that he can actually be at home. He can just be God. I mean, it's just like, you know, somebody coming home from work and you get home and you go, oh, that's Sabbath. That's what God says. Oh, I get to be God. And he actually says it that way. I get to be God. I get to order for people. I get to make a space where they can flourish. I get to make a space where they can actually relate with me. Oh, it feels so good. One of the things we miss because we don't read Hebrew is the idea of the expression of his joy in that cohortative piece and in the Sabbath. Like, because we've read Sabbath as law instead of principle, we begin to think Sabbath is this obligation. And God is so distraught because this is the place where he gets this great joy to be able to order for you. It's like, can think about when your kid is having maybe a special birthday or something, and you have just done everything right to make this day. And it gives you joy, right? It gives you joy to think about what he'd like to eat and maybe who he'd like to have over and how you can name the worth out of him, basically. That's how God feels about making Sabbath. Like, I get to make a place for you to live with me. This, like, there's nothing he enjoys more than producing image bearers who get to live with him. Like, there's nothing beyond that for God. But we'll have in Genesis 2 actually some kind of an expression, some kind of a translation of what that means for him. His telos is dwelling in Sabbath, dwelling in that place, in that space, where he can rule for the benefit of others and relate with others without obstacle. But he wants that telos to not just be his telos, but all of life's telos. That humanity is actually going to be created an embodied expression of himself, that he's given a name and differentiated and given value, that he's assigned a function. Remember, this is all review from a couple of lessons of image bearing, right? He's given him purpose to bear his image, to reflect him. And he's afforded him a unique ability to participate in life. He's given a tree some ability to participate in life, but he's given humans a unique ability, right? Why is it unique? Why is our life different and able to participate in life different from a tree's ability? Yeah, but what do we have?
Choice.
We have choice. Yeah.
He breathed in us.
Yeah, he breathed in. But if you read the Hebrew, he breathed into all the other things too. And that's why we've got to be so careful about how we're using the words. Yeah, he did breathe into us. But there's something different going on. I think if you go back to some of the lessons, you'll
that we get to help him do this,
right? So that's our second, right? Our second role, our second function, or not, right? Or not. So he wants to do this with humanity. He wants the telos of humanity to be there as well, and he also wants the telos to be an invitation to be priests, which is what Pat just brought up. That we get to help him do that. And I think for our purposes here, when we think about priests, I think we need to think about priests as being translators. So remember, God's speaking this language of connection, but it's perichoretic connection. It's connection of fully receiving the other and fully giving out the integrated other and self. So there's got to be a translation because God embodies the expression of that in his priests, right? And we look at the priest and we see what the priest look like. It's that the priest, Adam, we don't want to go into how Adam gets here, but again, Sabbath 1 and 2 really would help understanding that. Adam, as the priest in Genesis 2, 4 through 17, he gets to do a couple things, right, that just the image bearers didn't get to do, right? The image bearers were created. Now we have Adam, the priest, being created. He gets to cultivate. It says, Adam, you're to cultivate and keep the garden, right? What's the garden?
The temple.
The temple, which is Sabbath, which is the place where God dwells. So when we talk about Sabbath, we're talking about the garden. When we talk about the garden, we're talking about the temple. All of it's the same, right? Garden, temple, Sabbath, all the same. So don't think of the garden as the only place that there was creation. Remember, we've talked about that's what Genesis 2 is. That's a particular place within creation, Sabbath space. So to cultivate the garden, for Adam to cultivate the garden, what he needs to do is keep it accessible. Keep that garden accessible within all of earth. Open, assuring that it grows beyond its starting space. So we have earth, creation, and then we have Sabbath space that's supposed to grow and fill. But earth is supposed to grow. So it's a dual growing. What he's supposed to do here is express that Sabbath is opening for everybody, right? It's the home for everybody. And that's what the translator is supposed to do. As a priest, he's supposed to say, I'm expressing Sabbath is open for everyone, as home for everyone. You get to be in intimate contact with God, not far away contact. It's as if I'm a mirror and I'm supposed to mirror Yolanda. And Yolanda's saying, you want to mirror me even more? Come closer, right? So that the priest, the translator, is going to say, this is what Yolanda really looks like. Come and look closer. You see that? So cultivating the garden, keeping the garden. In other words, making sure that Sabbath stays Sabbath, that the garden stays garden, that it stays a place where God can rule and relate without obstacle. That's the tending that Adam is doing in the garden. He's making sure that the garden stays a place where God can reign and rule without obstacle. But the third thing he does, and we haven't really talked about this a lot, in 2 Genesis 2:16. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, from any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat from it you shall surely die. Okay, we've done lots of stuff on that. I think we all know what that means. What I want you to concentrate on here is it's the first time actually God speaks to Adam, right? Adam gets to hear. What did we say about hearing? It's the thing that makes connection, right? For Adam to be attuned to God, he needs to take that in, right? And pay complete attention to God. So Adam is attuned to him so that not only is Adam's function to keep the garden, cultivate the garden, but it's also to maintain connection by being attuned to God, by listening to God, by paying attention to what God is saying. Because remember, what God says is always an expression of who he is and what life is. So when God says that, he says, this is who I am, this is life. And remember, it's not a don't ever eat the tree of knowledge of good and evil. It's let me feed you, right? So Adam needs to do that. That's what Adam's integrated image bearing looks like. As an invitation or as a translator, this is what you're invited to do. As an image bearer, come and actually do more, be closer, be coming in to that. Way over. I'm gonna take 5 more minutes because this is the place where you want to end here. God is being attentive to Adam as well, right? How do you know? What does God say? Yeah, he needs a helper in this. It's not good for him to be alone because this is a big job to be able to do this. He needs a helper. So what we see here is God being attentive to Adam. And in doing that, we know that God is helping or allowing Adam to participate, right, in the perichoretic. He's paying attention to what Adam needs, which is exactly what God always does. He's always paying attention to us. And what he asks us to do, pay attention to me so that you can be in this perichoretic. And so he gives Adam a helper, right? And if Adam is a priest, what is the helper? Priest as well, right? So when we talk about the woman being Adam's helper, we're talking about the woman being a priest as well. So we have now two priests. Before that, of course, we have Adam reflecting God in naming the animals, right? He echoes what God does. He names the animals. He differentiates the animals. This is a cow and this is not. So he's being creative. And he recognizes their function is not the same, but he's connected to them in a different way. But what happens to Adam is that he gets energized in the participation because God pays attention to him and his needs. And he gives him what he needs. And Adam then receives the other. Adam receives Eve, the woman. Verse 23, and the man said, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. What is happening here is Adam is translating the joy of perichoretic connection. What he's doing is translating for humanity what the Trinity feels in its connection. So when you read that in Hebrew, if you were someone who read Hebrew, you would read that as, oh my, wow, this is so cool. That's how you would read it. It really loses a lot of emphasis when we read it in the English, right? Bone in my bone and flesh in my flesh. This is like, oh, this is, if you're going to use a movie quote, you complete me type of thing. This, oh, my, I love it. This is so cool. She's like me and she's not like me. She's other and she's us. What Adam is doing here is echoing what God does all the time in himself. There is this absolute joy that comes from receiving fully the connection of the other into my life and then me giving out that. I can't emphasize enough the joy that is displayed in this these few words here, and that it is the echo of what God feels in connection with himself. And then in connection with what comes out of that. The joy that is expressed for God in unity with diversity, the joy that comes out is the fruit, Adam, Eve. That is his joy. So when we say things like, you're my pride and joy, that's actually what God says. That's God's language. That's the context by which all of us begin life. That's the real context. So when Bill told me, no, that's not true to my picture, it stopped me from saying, oh, maybe there is another language. And I will tell you, we're going to go more into Adam, but I will tell you the end of that story. So a week passes, and I'm in church, and I'm completely immersed in worship. Not thinking about anything but what we were singing, and I'm really talking to God. And God puts this picture in my head. Literally, I felt like it just went like this. It was that picture I had in the hospital of me as a baby, and it was Jesus throwing me up in the air. I just start crying and crying. I'm like I wasn't thinking about that. I wasn't. But Jesus replaced that picture with, no, the reason I wasn't holding you, I was catching you. I was throwing you up in the air and catching you. It completely changed my picture, right? And it will infiltrate my languages of, no, this great joy. I'm surprised and yet not surprised that I have never had that picture because I've never been attentive to that picture. Mm-hmm. But to be attentive to the picture that he gives me now is the picture that he's giving us all in Genesis 1 and 2 is I'm throwing, you are like, oh, this is so fun. I love having you. I love that you are the fruit of the joy of being connected, Holy Spirit, with Son, with Father. That's what comes out of perichoretic union. That is God's language. This joy of integrative connection for each one of us. That's the language, that's the context of God and the telos of God that he expects us to move toward, that place where we're living in that place all the time and not just every once in a while. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
You know, Jill, what really struck me earlier and then from what you just said, because that happened when you were worshiping. You know, and the Bible talks about how God inhabits the praises of his mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. And he actually delights. He sings over us. And it's amazing to me when I was thinking about it, just the fact that, because I was wondering, you know, why does God enjoy our praises? Mm-hmm. But he really does. Mm-hmm. And he enters in.
Yep.
That was so...
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that verse. We're going to bring that up next week, and we'll see how that plays in to all of this. So obviously there's lots here, right? There's lots unpack in here. Mm-hmm. But I want you to leave with that language. I want you to leave with God's language. That's what life means. Life means an integrative connection that produces joy, that has this overabundant joy of, and we're the fruit of that joy. You're going to see that in James, and you're going to see how that changes the picture of what James is asking of us. So because I've gone over, we're not going to go to the confession. I'm not going to finish through there. How did I ever think I was going to go in chapter 3? But it's beautiful. Wait till you see chapter 3. I think you'll be pretty amazed. Father, thank you for this time together. Thank you for your word. Thank you for your joy that we are actually your joy. Mm-hmm. Father, I pray that our languages might gradually begin to change and be formed by the language that you say is life, mm-hmm. that we might be integratively connected with you and with one another, that might bring us joy as we fully, vulnerably open ourselves up to receive the other, and that we might integrate and give out all that you've given us with each expression of yourself in someone else. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Amen.